Hey everyone, as we wrap up Back to Basics month, we're going to do a throwback to episode 56 when we got to tour the Brown-Forman Cooperage and talk about the barrel building process. This seems like a good fit to put us across the finish line. Next week, we're going to be back with a brand new episode. Don't forget to buy your tickets to the Kentucky Derby Museum's Legend Series taking place on April 20th, featuring the president of Old Forester, Campbell Brown. Tickets are $75 per person or $65 if you're a museum member, and they can be purchased online at derbymuseum.org. We're very happy to give away a few bottles of bourbon this month to our Patreon supporters. We always like to talk about Heaven Hill Bottle and Bond, being a Kentucky-only release, and we talk about it all the time on the community roundtables, but this gives some more people a chance to try it. And we're very happy to be able to give those away to the people that actually won this month. If you want to be a part of the drawing next month, make sure you support us on Patreon. We've got sponsorships just starting at $1 a month, and $5 a month gets you into the drawing. Visit patreon.com. That's patreon.com/bourbonpursuit. Welcome back to the episode of the Bourbon Pursuit Podcast. Kenny and Ryan here today, and we are at another location. This is actually a very first for us. We're at our first cooperage.
Yeah, we've been wanting to come to one for so long, and it was just so cool to see like what goes on, and like we just went through the whole process, and I'm excited for our listeners to kind of, you know, this, the barrel's where a lot of the magic happens, so I'm excited for the listeners to kind of get to, you know, some knowledge on what the process is on getting the, you know, from wood to, from the tree to the barrel, you know, to the finished product. So I'm excited about today's episode.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really cool just because of the fact that, as you said, I mean, there's so much flavoring, so many characteristics that go into bourbon that just comes from the barrel itself, and you kind of forget about the process that even gets to that part, because everybody is so fascinated with going to distilleries and they see the, you know, the whiskey being made, but they don't realize that like that's going to taste like crap until it really ages and matures, and what's going into these, I don't know if you would call it artisanal, but I mean it's a very handmade product that goes into making this sort of stuff.
Yeah, and it's pretty cool. It puts things in perspective too, how much the bourbon industry is like impacting our economy. When like we rolled through there, I'm not sure how many workers, we'll ask Michael, but just so many, you know, workers and supplies and all these parts that just, you know, you need to have to keep this industry alive, that it really impacts our economy. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, today we are at the Brown-Forman Cooperage. We'll talk a little bit more about it and what makes it unique and special, but there was a release of Cooper's Craft that just happened recently, and it was named, it's actually one of the first brands that are coming out of Brown-Forman in ages that isn't, you know, Woodford
or Old Forester. Yeah.
Or Jack Daniels or whatever, right? So it's one of their new labels, and it's being named after the Cooperage here. So I think that's pretty exciting, and we're going to get Michael's take on that as well. But there's also kind of a little fun fact for any of those soccer fans that are out there, that the number one team in USL right now is Louisville City, who just wrapped up their 15-game win streak and are getting ready to head to the playoffs. But the local supporters, or the hooligans, whatever you want to call them, they're actually called the Louisville Coopers.
Cool.
So kind of all, it all comes full circle here. So with that, good segue to introduce our guest. So today we have Michael Nelson. Michael is the plant director at the Brown-Forman Cooperage. So Michael, welcome to the show.
Welcome.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yep.
So let's get a little bit more background about you. So first, did you just come to Brown-Forman from a machinery background, or do you have affinity with bourbon at all before you came here, or how'd that kind of start?
No, so my background's in manufacturing, specifically construction materials, but I've been around processes where you're making something my whole life. You know, my dad, my grandfather, they were in manufacturing type industries, and so I've been around it, hearing about it at the dinner table since I was a kid. And so it's, although making a barrel is something I hadn't done before I came to Brown-Forman, not too many people in the world right. Are doing it anymore, but it was a pleasure to get to come here and learn this process, because it's so unique. So it's, there's nothing else out there that's like this place.
Lots of Legos as kids.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah.
So I guess, did you have a affinity or a love affair with bourbon before you started here? Or is it just kind of a byproduct of maybe working here or something like that?
It's probably closer to a byproduct. I've always been drawn to tradition and heritage, and you know, anything that's truly American has always kind of been a draw to me. And the culture that is around bourbon, that's, you know, inherent in Kentucky, that's probably the thing that I brought with me here was that appreciation for the tradition of anything that's really American. And this place, I don't think you can find any place any more American and traditional than this cooperage. Yeah. It's in the heart of Kentucky, which is in the heart of America, using American white oak with an American workforce, making a container and a barrel for American bourbon. I mean, it's what's so cool about it.
Yeah, coming off of 4th of July, we're all just going to get American flag tattoos after that. that comment right there, right?
Proud to be American.
Yeah.
So give us, before we get into the technicalities of barrels and char and all that good stuff, kind of talk about a little bit of the history of the grounds here. I mean, so how familiar are with the building? How long has it been in existence? When was the first production? All that sort of stuff.
Yeah, the cooperage has been around since the 40s, the mid-40s. It started as a furniture factory. And when Brown-Forman bought it after the Second World War, they turned it into a new barrel cooperage, and that's what it's been doing and operating as ever since. So the place has been around for a long time, decades, 70 years. We just celebrated our 70th anniversary this year, and it was an opportunity to show our appreciation for the employees, the men and women that are in the cooperage making the barrels. Without them, you know, we wouldn't have what we have. You wouldn't have a lot of the great bourbons that we enjoy. And so it was an opportunity to honor our most senior employee, who's now got 47 years in this place, and he's in better shape than I'll ever be, and says that he's going to go to 50 years. So, you know, we're proud to have Charlie working here. So, you know, we celebrated Charlie's tenure here, and also it was a chance to be able to recognize all of our employees that have had 30-plus years in this place, and we've got a number of them. And you know, once people get in here, they don't leave.
Right. Now, I guess one thing that we need to give our listeners, and we had the opportunity to go, and you gave us a private tour of the facility, and not a lot of people, maybe when they make it to Kentucky, they kind of forget to go check out a cooperage, but kind of give the cooperage 101, if you will, right? Kind of talk about some of the process that you showed us through, but kind of, you know, in words this time instead of being able to see it visually.
Yeah, so you've got a – first of all, bourbon has to be – stored in a new white oak, charred white oak container. So we've got a few sawmills in our portfolio as Brown-Forman, to where we quarter saw the lumber that comes into our yard, which we then let season. We let it season out in the open air, and then we introduce it.
Any time frame that usually seasons?
Yeah, we like to have it season at least 6 months. That's our preference. It can season for specific products years, literally. You know, we've got some wood out in the yard that's been around 5 years just seasoning. And, you know, you may see an expression from one of our brands at some point with that wood. And so, but we like for it to season at least 6 months, and you know, we'll get it age it longer than that if we can.
So how do you keep something that's sitting outside for 5 years, like away from maybe elements or bugs or pests or anything like that?
Bugs and pests aren't really an issue. We don't, you know, other than a wasp's nest here and there. You know, we're not dealing with
carry around raid with you.
Yeah, you know, anything that's gonna have a negative effect on the wood, and we want the elements to hit it. We want it to be rained on. We want the wind to hit it. We want the snow to hit it. You know, that's what we're seasoning it, and we want Mother Nature to do its thing and dry it for us as well. You know, it's cheapest way to dry lumber is let Mother Nature do it, but it can only do so much. So then we have to introduce it into our kilns, and we dry it to our moisture specifications, and then it's ready to be introduced into the process.
So we kind of got an idea that we saw it go from, actually, we didn't get to see the yard because I'm sure it's massive, but it went from a yard to like an indoor drying area, right? And you said, I mean, it was pretty massive. It's like an airplane hangar, right?
Yeah, so we store our wood in that, what we call dry storage. We store the wood in there. After it's dry, we don't want to let it get rained on once we've dried it. So we'll introduce it into dry storage, and then it's ready for production.
So how often are you going through this airplane hangar full of wood?
We'll turn that over about once a week. And it's you get in there, and there's lots of white oak in there. You know, it's a pretty, you can smell it. It's cool. You know,
it's got impressive.
It's got a nice smell to it, and it's cool to see. But relatively speaking, we don't consume a lot of wood relative to the market, to the industry, to the housing market drives wood consumption. So we still stay pretty tight to The forestry industry, because we have a vested interest, our entire industry has a vested interest in seeing that the white oak is around forever. It's a sustainable resource, and we intend to keep it that way and support the forestry industry where we can as a company, because it's critical to our business.
Right. So after it goes from the drying area, did we see it go through like a planer or something like that, yep, where it's cutting edges or smoothing it or
that? We get the raw staves and heading pieces that have been cut at the mill. We dry them, and then we introduce them into the process, which starts with planing the wood, which puts smooth surfaces on the top and bottom, and then we do what we call joining the wood, and that's putting the edge on the sides of the board of the pieces of heading and staves, so then the staves can fit tightly together to make a barrel, because at the end of the day, the object of this game is to make a tight-fitting barrel that holds a liquid, that liquid being whiskey.
Right, because we saw the joining of the pieces come together, and then we saw it go over to another individual who's sitting there, and it's almost like a mathematical equation in his head, right? Trying to figure out exactly which pieces
he's pulling out staves, sticking them in a hoop,
trying to figure out which ones are going to fit.
Yeah,
correctly.
So you're referring to the barrel raisers. The barrel raisers, after the wood's been planed and jointed and shaped properly, the barrel raiser has to fit and select the individual staves into the shape of a barrel, and she is counting the number of staves that are going into that barrel and also selecting different width sizes as they go, doing all this in 40, 50 seconds on average. And they can do it a lot faster if they need to. But they're counting in their head. They're making sure the stave's not backwards. They're selecting different width sizes and making sure that barrel is going to be a nice tight fit.
So how many staves are usually on average in a barrel?
On average, there's about 31 staves in a barrel. And again, the barrel raisers are counting that in their head and making sure that whatever number we've got set up to put in a barrel, that they're hitting it right on.
Is there a reason why you would go fat, skinny, fat, instead of just being like, we're just going to have all fat barrels or all skinny staves?
Yeah, it's you're talking geometry at that point, and it's probably more technical than you guys care to know. But yeah,
it's angles,
so
right?
It's you've got the circumference and you've got the circle and the bilge size that we refer to, and it's the angles of the individual staves have to be very precise in order to fit that circumference we're going for.
Right. So he's putting it kind of or he or she is looking at it, trying to piece them all together. They piece them together, but it's not necessarily a barrel at that point. You kind of have almost like a faux ring at the bottom that sort of puts them together.
So
then what's the next step after
it looks sort of like an open flower at that point.
So it's like a blooming onion.
Yeah, it's bloomed open, an open flower, an open onion. And then from that point, we introduce we introduce some heat and steam back into the wood, because now it needs to be a little bit pliable, because we're going to shape it into that curved barrel shape that you're used to seeing when you see a barrel. So we introduce the steam and heat back into that barrel, and then we have a machine called a windlass that then squeezes the top of that barrel back together. And at that point, those staves have a curve to them, and it starts to look like a barrel at that point.
I'm just amazed by how quick the process goes through, because I've seen craftsmen woodworkers, and they're like, yeah, to make this wood bend, like, we have to soak it for like at least 3 weeks in water, and then we have to bend it, and we have to get clamps to make sure it doesn't move. But you guys are making, from, let's say, from the beginning of a run when something's first getting planed to the end of the barrel actually being out there, if you were to say, like, we could do this in a fastest time, what would it be?
Yeah, that's always a tricky one to answer. I get that one a lot, and it's because we make our material in sections. We walk through the different departments: our heading department, our stave department, our barrel raising department, and then we've got our windlass and different machines. It doesn't flow straight from one end to the other, but we could take a barrel half an hour to get through the process.
Right. Okay, so it goes through its steam. We put the rings on. What's next after the rings? Because now we're getting into like almost the fun part, right? We're seeing some fire happen.
Right. So before that, we toast it. We've got the temporary rings on, and then we put it through the windlass machine that shapes it. And now it goes through our toasting room, we call it. And so the toasting room, you didn't get to see because it's proprietary. We're pretty proud of that, even though we can't show it off. It's designed in-house, and it's a radiant heat that starts to caramelize the sugars in the wood and gives it a nice toast. It's like toasting a marshmallow. If you radiate that, get that radiation from the heat over a campfire, you get that nice golden brown. Well, that's what we're doing to the wood. We're caramelizing those sugars and changing the composition of those sugars. And then from that point, we send the barrel through a machine called the Buffaloes. Why? The machines were made in Buffalo, New York, 80 years ago. Yeah. They're old, the big cast iron machines, which a lot of our equipment is. And so that rolls out and smooths the barrel and helps to shape it, again, align in those side joints that we call the sides of the stave, so it's nice, tight fit. And that machine also tightens that barrel up good and tight before it goes to the char fire, which is the big grand finale that everybody loves to see because it's pretty cool to see.
Yeah.
So the char fire is then literally catching the inside of that barrel on fire. And then we'll let it burn as long as we choose to for whatever specifications we're going for. And we'll let it burn, and then we'll quench it. We'll spritz some water in it, and then puts out the fire, and down the process it goes.
Now, so what's next after that? Because what were you about to say?
Well, you know, when we were looking at the toasted versus the charred, and Kenny asked, why would you toast it if you're going to char it anyways? And we kind of saw the depth of the whiskey moving in and out of the barrel. I guess talk about why you do toast it before charring it.
And that's a great question, because it's something that we take a lot of pride in, is our ability to toast how we toast. And we like to set that toast deep into the wood. And what that allows the whiskey to do is have a lot of interaction as that whiskey sets in the warehouse. It's literally, and you guys saw that used stave that you could see the soak line, that whiskey's literally going in and out of that wood as the temperatures change and pressures inside that barrel changes. And that's also why you get different results from different levels and locations in those rick houses and those barrel houses, is because you're getting more drastic temperature changes up high. It's getting hotter on a day like today. I mean, it's got to be hot in some of those upper floors of those warehouses on a day like today in July, and to where it's going to cool down tonight, and that whiskey is going in and out of that wood, and it's cycling in and out of that wood more, pulling more flavor out and changing the color and the flavor of the whiskey in there.
Yeah, I'm not sure how deep or to the depth of each stave is, but it looked like it was almost 60 or 70%, you know, inside
the whiskey.
That.
Yeah, exactly. It'll soak. Some stave's about an inch.
Some is all the way through.
And it'll soak almost all the way through, but it's going at least halfway through that stave at some point in its life, probably multiple times in its life in the warehouse.
So it's going halfway through, and we kind of touched on this when we were doing the tour. Well, why wouldn't you could make almost two times more barrels if you split the size of the wood that you're making the stave out of in half, and why wouldn't you do that?
So the thickness of the stave is, we don't want that whiskey to come all the way out through that wood and leak out. Because anything that, you know, you refer to it as the angel share, any of the angel share, whether it's evaporation or just a pure leak in the barrel, it's not going in a bottle. And that's not why we're going through all this effort to make this whiskey.
They get their shares already.
So. Yeah, they're going to get their share. That's part of the process. So we don't want them to have more than their fair share, as we say.
Right.
So if that stave is any less thick than what we make it, then there's going to be too much loss in that barrel.
Right. So after you char it, then what? Because there has to be a quality control process, right?
Yeah, so we char it, and then it goes, and we put the groove in it that right after the char fire, that then the heads go in that groove, and that's what the heads sit in. It's called a croze. So the crozier, the machine that puts the croze, the groove, and the angle in the top of the barrel that you can see, then the head is inserted and then tightened. And from there, it makes its way over to what we call our hoopers, where they drive the final hoops, the iron hoops down on the barrel. And you've got a quarter hoop, a bilge hoop, and a head hoop on each end of both ends of the barrel. And so we drive those hoops on. And from there, we put the bunghole in it. And then we pressurize each barrel. Every single barrel we make gets pressurized with air and water. And what that does is lets us detect leaks. So if we pressurize the barrel with air and water and we see bubbles or water coming out of a joint or a hole or some defect in the wood, every barrel that we make gets ran through an inspection. And so we have an inspector that inspects and then makes a repair to that barrel that's showing a defect or a leak. Because again, there's no point in putting all this effort into making a barrel that's not going to hold whiskey. So we make sure we repair every barrel. Any major defects we send to what we call our coopers. Our more seasoned, you see a lot of 30, 40-year employees working in the coopering area, where what we refer to as the coopers will change out an entire head if need be, or they can replace an entire stave without that barrel falling apart and do any major repairs to the barrels. And then they'll check them again for leaks and send them on down the line. And from there, they pretty much are on a truck heading to a distillery to get filled with whiskey.
There was one thing that we saw that was pretty interesting, and you kind of showed us that you also do these kind of like almost, I don't want to say a cross cut, but you said it was something where like a blade goes through and kind of
chops it up a little bit for surface area. Kind of talk about that.
We have some what we consider some competitive advantages over others by owning our own cooperage. We can do things. What you're referring to is we call them grooved barrels. So we can set grooves or route grooves in the barrels, and we can use those in certain products and sort of another ingredient that we have that we can put into our portfolio, and it again. We can have some control over what our whiskey looks like and tastes like.
Right. So, I mean, you said this quality control person. Is it just one person there, like, looking for bubbles? And how much time would they really spend looking to make sure that a barrel's not leaking? Like, what other kind of safeguards or fail-safes do you really have there to make sure that something's not going to leave the warehouse and be like, oh, crap, send it back. Our bad guys.
Yeah, right? It's that air and water pressure. If you've ever... I think of it like this. If you've ever taken some soapy water and sprayed on a tire that may have a leak in it, and you'll see those little bubbles. Well, we're not spraying soapy water on the barrel, but we are pressurizing it from the inside out, and you'll see little bubbles, air bubbles start to come through, and that's a pretty good indication of if that barrel's going to leak or not. And so we make sure we make 2,600 barrels a day here, and we touch every one of them, and they're set up where they can spin that barrel around and look for those air bubbles or water leaks so we can repair it. And that's pretty good indication of whether that barrel is going to leak or not, is that inspection process and pressurization we put it through.
And I'm sure that moisture plays a huge role into that in leaking. And you said at the very beginning you do dry age, and then you even dry it more, and then you got kilns. But kind of talk a little bit more in depth about how moisture would affect the process and like what you do to overcome that.
Yeah, so we want the moisture to be where we want it, I guess, when we introduce it into the process. But then that's so we can machine the wood early on. Anybody that's in the woodworking industry knows that you're not going to shave or cut or machine wet wood very well. It's going to tear, and it's not going to do what you want. So we have to dry it so we can machine it. And then we're unique that we introduce moisture back into it so then we can then shape it. And then we are unique for the woodworking industry as well, the cooperage industry. We're going to fill our barrel with a liquid. Where a furniture maker, they're concerned about their table or their chair or their dresser is going to dry out and crack. We're not so concerned with that because we're going to fill it with a liquid and let it soak for 4 to 7 years. And so that's the old timers will tell you that the best cooper on earth is liquid or water, because that wood's going to start to swell. So if there's some minor leak or it's maybe starting to get a little moist around a joint, that wood's going to swell up as it sits in the warehouse and it's going to seal itself.
Oh, okay. So it's like its own personal built-in Band-Aid, if you will.
It is, literally.
Oh, so during the quality control process, how many average number of barrels would you say are ever like discarded, right? Because it sounds like you've got two fail stops there. You've got one that's like, okay, we can do a minor repair, and then like if it's a major repair, it goes to the cooper. So it sounds like you have very minimal waste whatsoever.
It's very minimal waste. The reason being is we can, even if a barrel would literally fall back into individual pieces, we can gather that back up and try it again. So we're not going to throw anything in the dumpster and send it to a landfill. First of all, it's not good business sense because we paid for that wood, so we're going to use it. And we like to say we were green before green was cool. If you guys remember, you heard a humming noise in the background, a constant hum, even when we were back in the tour room where it was kind of quiet. That's our dust collection system, and we used our wood shavings that we're shaving to fuel our wood boiler. So we then use for our steam that we use in the plant, and even for heat in the winter, we're using that sawdust to fuel our heating system. And so we're really wasting nothing.
Right. So it really is kind of lean, right? You're saving money while you're doing it, saving a little bit of the planet while you're at it. And we noticed that we were going through there that it's a very, very automated process now. So kind of talk about, is there any process that it doesn't have any sort of machinery involved anymore? Or is it, you know, and how would they do this before? And maybe you can give us a little bit of insight, like when these machines were manufactured and put in as part of the process.
Yeah. I mean, barrels have been around for literally hundreds and hundreds of years. And before petroleum, before there was containers and bags that we use today, everything was in a barrel. It wasn't uncommon to go to the hardware store and see a barrel full of nails or screws, or they shipped apples or fruit. You know, barrels were the only option for a container. Probably not that long ago, you know, 120 years ago, barrels were the only container available. Back in the days.
No Tupperware back then.
No Tupperware. I mean, slack barrels were for storing things other than liquid, and then tight barrels, which we're making over here to cooperage is what they would use for holding any kind of liquid, including whiskey. So as the industry has subsided, the cooperage industry, there's not a cooperage in every small town like there was once. The only thing that's keeping cooperages alive is the whiskey industry, and it's because it's an ingredient in the whiskey. I mean, a lot of people may not be familiar with the whiskey goes in that barrel clear. It's clear, and it gets 100% of its color from the barrel, and it gets at least 50% of the flavor from the barrel as well.
So most distilleries, I guess, outsource their cooperage, you know, to other companies. Why did Brown-Forman decide to do it in-house, and what kind of advantages, other than supply, I guess, does it give you all?
Yeah, so, you know, we control our supply, and it's also an advantage to where it's not uncommon for a master distiller like Chris Morris to come out, and we can play with the toast levels or the char levels, and we can try new things. You know, our double-oaked Woodford is a perfect example of being able to control the process in-house to where we can experiment. It's not uncommon for our Brown-Forman's research and development department, who we work very close with out here at the cooperage, to come out and we'll try different things because we can, and why not? You know, a lot of good products have come out of trial and error.
How hard is it to tweak something like that, right? To be like, oh, okay, we need this certain level chart, can't be this, and you gotta be, they'll be like, Michael, go back to the computers and punch in number two this time, or like, how hard is it to tweak some of that process?
For us, for the toasting and char, it's really not too hard, we've set it up that way on purpose, to where we can change char levels by how long we let the wood burn, and you know, that's how you're getting your char is fire, and that's, you know, not... Technology hasn't taken over that aspect yet. You know, if you've got fire and you've got wood, you can char. Toasting, you can toast as well, but we've got our proprietary method to where we're fairly automated and we can really control it. And the other thing we can be, which we're happy to that we can, is we can be very consistent. We can have, you know, if we want a certain toast level, we can get very close to that same toast level all barrels that we make, you know, 2,600 a day can be very consistent to where if we're trying to toast with a little campfire over an open flame, it's a little harder to control that temperature and that toast.
So this, I'm going to ask a question. It may be a dumb question on my part, but is char level like an industry standard? Because, you know, you can see some brands and they're pretty open. They'll be like, oh, this is char number four or something like that. Like, is that like an industry standard, or you guys just be like, no, like
we just do
45 seconds and like, that's what we call
it's
our
both.
Thing.
You know, a number four char, that can be a pretty typical, you know, run of the mill char, but, you know, the double oaked, back to the double oaked, that's a different char. That's its own specific char level, and it's got a drastically different toast level for the second round of barrels that we put that double oaked through. So it's both. You know, we don't really go, I would say, by what the industry, if the industry's doing what we think is best, we've got no problem going on doing the same things as everybody else. But when we can go off on our own and have something maybe a little different and change things and control things better, we'll go off and do that as well.
So talk about a little bit more about the process of wood in general. I know you kind of gave us a little insider secret, but, you know, I was trying to come up questions with this. I was thinking, like, well, it has to be just the rate of inflation and the way things work. I mean, is it getting more costly every single year to produce barrels just because wood might be at an all-time shortage or anything like that?
Yeah, we don't get to hide from anything that the rest of the world, you know, inflation's going up, the cost of goods are going up, the cost of everything continues to rise, so the cost of a barrel continues to rise. And you know, that's where scale helps, having the size of facility we do, making 2,600 barrels a day. We can use scale to our advantage, but we're also every day looking for a more efficient way to do it, looking for a better way to do it. We're, you know, out here at 4:30 the other morning asking some of our employees in a safety meeting, okay, what are your ideas? How can we make this more efficient? What can we do? You know, I'm always under the theory or the thought process that the person doing the job knows it better than anybody else on earth. If you're standing at a machine or making something for 10, 12 hours a day, who else knows that process better? Not me. You know, it's that person that's doing the work. So
you got all these suits coming here telling us what to do, right?
Yeah. I mean, we've all thought it, and we've all suffered that, and we've all been there in the manufacturing industry. So how can we leverage the diverse workforce that we have at the Cooperage, and we've got a diverse workforce in every aspect of the word, and we love it. You know, we got young, we've got old, we've got different nationalities and genders and races, and we always are looking for a way to use that to our advantage, taking that diverse group of people, and there's an advantage in there somewhere. And so how can we leverage that to you know, be a little more efficient than the next guy, the competition?
So another on that too,
go for it.
You know, with the bourbon boom, obviously you all are filling more barrels being used. How's the oak supply? Is it getting hit? Or I mean, like, is there a lot more available, or is it, you know, hard for you to I guess get the raw materials?
Yeah, and that's a great question, because that's, as I alluded to before, that's very near and dear to our hearts, because without a sustainable oak source, you know, I'm looking for a job. And so the supply is there. We don't drive the market. The housing industry drives the market. So we're competing on the open market for timber. And when the housing industry is up, supply is up. When the housing industry goes down, supply goes down. So there's no problems sourcing wood. There's money to be made in it for the loggers and the mills. So they're producing and we're buying, and it's in our best interest to be efficient. You know, we talk about being green. It's a cost thing too. It's cost efficient to, you know, if we buy a stick of wood, we want to use every last piece of fiber in that board that we can. It's just the right thing to do.
And you said you use somewhere around like 1% of what would be the net total of white oak that is out there. Something
like
that. Yeah,
in the lumber world and in the wood industry, you know, we're a very small player in that. We don't by any means drive the market and what's available. We're just at the mercy of the market. It seems like a lot of barrels, and it is, but relative to other woodworking players in the world, we're not that big.
So it's, yeah, I was gonna say, was supply kind of short a little bit in like the 2008 era when the housing market was down or anything like that?
I think it was, but so was, you know, the demand wasn't where it was today either. This cooperage is producing more than it ever has, and that's a good thing. You know, it's a good thing for the economy. It's a good thing for the business, and it's a good thing for the state. It's neat to be a part of something that's thriving, and people, you know, we're sitting here talking about a factory. You know, you don't get to experience that in a lot of other industries. So it's people have an interest in what we do, and that's something we're pretty proud of.
Right. It kind of reminds me of that show that it was always on, like, Discovery Channel. It's called, like, How It's Made, and you get to see, like, how in the factory, how everything's put together and stuff. So it was totally interesting. So last question I want to ask you and kind of get your take on it, because you're sitting here, you're sporting the badge, you got your shirt on that has Cooper's Craft on it. So what does Cooper's Craft mean to you, coming that it is a new brand coming out, and it's named after the Cooperage itself?
Yeah, Cooper's Craft is Brown-Forman's newest brand in 20 years since Woodford. And so it's pretty cool to be a part of the Cooperage who the brand is honoring. It's honoring the men and women that have been doing this for 70 years. And it's I'm proud to be part of that, and I haven't been doing this for 30, 40 years like a lot of these employees have, so it's kind of neat to be able to honor them. You saw what they do. They're working. There's physical labor over there. It's hard. When it's hot out, it's hot in there. When it's humid out, it's humid in there. When it's cold out, it's cold in the Cooperage. And so, you know, they're true American workers. You know, it started with that, and, you know, I think it's appropriate to end with that in Cooper's Craft, because it honors the workers and the tradition that goes into making a barrel that we've been doing for a long, long time here at the Brown-Forman Cooperage.
Oh, awesome. Well, Michael, again, thank you so much for being on the show today. This was fantastic to first cross off a Cooperage on our list, right? Yeah. I mean, that was awesome. I think it was really
one of the cooler things we've done.
Yeah. I know. I mean, we've done plenty of our distillery tours, but we don't really get to see the beginnings of the process on how everything's made.
Yeah, it was. I'm always blown away when you go to these, you know, big players in the spirits industry, and just the scale and mass of the production and how automated they have everything. And like you said, the workers and how many people are impacted by this industry. It's really cool. So
Awesome. So if you like what you hear, make sure you subscribe to us on iTunes. You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And if you like what you hear, make sure you support the show. That's Patreon, patreon.com/bourbonpursuit.
Yeah, we need gas money to, you know, come over here to Shively. Is it Shively?
No, this is by the airport. This is easy.
We're sandwiched between the airport and Churchill.
Churchill, yeah. Gotcha. We forgot to say, people can tour here, right?
Yeah, Mint Julep Tours is who they would have to contact to schedule a tour. You know, we're not open to just come knock on the door and come take a tour.
Unless you have your Bourbon Pursuit gear with you, then you can do whatever you want.
Unless you're a celebrity like you guys.
And carry around a bunch of mics and you can do a lot of stuff.
But yeah, Mint Julep Tours is who we schedule tours through currently.
There you go. So now you know if you want to come see Michael and take a tour of the Cooperage, you know what to do. So Michael, again, thank you so much for being on the show. Ryan, close us out.
Yeah, guys, if you have any show suggestions, feedback, comments, and obviously we'd love your money too at Patreon. just kidding. But we just want to keep this thing going, and we appreciate you all listening, and we'll see you next time.